Today's program has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza, robertaspizza.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Eating Disorder.
Our guest just told us she feels like she's at Wayne's World.
Yeah, you pretty much got it. Rock so on.
Excellent.
Yep. Our moms will be yelling down the stairs at us very soon.
Wood paddling on the walls.
I forgot my flannel shirt. Oh.
And the baseball hat.
That too.
So how's everybody doing? Crazy Legs, you had a competition last weekend.
I was at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut, and it was an entire turkey eating contest.
Were you eating chips? How many chips you could eat?
I had a few chips. You can't just eat one. It was in the tradition of Thanksgiving. We often have done medley foods where you get turducken and then some sides. But in recent years, we've done entire turkeys, and these are the biggest birds yet on the Major League Eating Circuit. 22 pounds, cooked down to 20 pounds. You have 10 minutes to eat as much as you can. And in past years, I've had a 9-pound bird. So I'm able to get to the... I always save the Pope's nose for the last bite. I get to the dark meat, and I enjoy it. These, much like my favorite porn star, Janine Lindemuehler, I couldn't handle the breasts. So I couldn't manage... I mean, just like... fondling them and taking them off the bird was difficult enough. It reminded me of my prom night, and I just couldn't finish it all. So I did very poorly.
Picture this turkey in a bra, you know?
Yes.
That's a sexy bird.
A sexy bird. But if you're curious to know what happens after, well, my understanding
is... Did you cry?
No, never mind.
That's an experience I had
I put
once.
The skin over my face and poked holes in it. We now have... a YouTube page, correct?
Correct.
So this is going to be... I'm going to put you guys on the spot, but have either of you noticed what happened after the contest via two freshly minted videos that are up on our YouTube page?
I saw the first one. I didn't check the second one. So what did happen?
Well, there's only three videos total on the page. How did you... That only fits on one page. You only saw the first one?
No. I was
attention span.
Yeah. I had that thing the other day.
Right.
All right, Reverend. So where can people find our YouTube channel?
Well, wait. Let me guess. Sorry. It's on YouTube. Yeah. I'm gonna do a Johnny Carson Kreskin thing.
No, it's called The Eating Disorder on YouTube. It's the Eating Disorder channel. Look up Eating Disorder Radio. You'll find it.
Tell
us. The suspense is killing me. Well, I did watch it, but I don't want to ruin it for the public.
I found the sweetbreads giblet bag of some other eaters. I couldn't find my own. I think I may have eaten the sweetbreads in the bag during the contest, which don't weigh that much. But then
really?
I did a wishbone with Michelle Lesko. I have an injury here to prove it. And
it's a bird-related injury.
I feel that nothing tastes better than the leftovers from a competitive eater's plate, so I was able to eat like Matt Stoney's sweetbreads, and he normally wears skinny jeans, so you know those things are pretty pressed together. And then the leftover turkey was great, too. No, the Pope's nose was my favorite, made famous by Julia Child.
The part that went over the fence last.
Yes. Yeah. So it was fatty and delicious and good. And I realized both before and after, I traveled with a guy who's been on our show, Yasser, Doggy Bag Salim. He went to Philly to run a marathon the day after. He brought me back some cheesesteaks the day before. I got back on Sunday. I went to Professor Tom's, and I ate 25 chicken wings. So for 3 days, I was on a meat cleanse.
Nice.
That's all I ate, a meat cleanse.
It's good for the energy.
I tried to wash out all the vegetables in my
system. All right. So wait. Joey Chestnut won this one, right?
9 pounds.
Okay. 9 pounds he ate. Can we prank him and then put it on the show?
You probably shouldn't. If you're going to prank him, let's not mention it on the air.
Oh, because he listens.
Well, actually, at the event, two gentlemen, the Fink brothers, who run a competitive eating podcast, said that they really enjoy our brand of visual radio. So visual someone radio. Someone is out there listening.
Yep. I mean, because right now I'm doing Pilates. No one can see it, but that's what I'm, you know.
You know, and as usual.
We could see it, and your unitard is riding high. Every time he turns around to do a sun, you know, it looks like someone juggling two plates of mashed potatoes.
Smuggling grapes.
Yeah.
What? How did Yasser do with running the marathon after getting all hepped up on tryptophan?
So I thought I was sort of the man who could. I did Pelmeni, and then I ran the New York Marathon. I did hot dogs and ran Boston. He's done an ultra marathon, three marathons, and he ate Twinkies. He ate like 40 Twinkies. The next day he ran the Harrisburg Marathon. He did Turkey and he ran Philly, and he's doing it in like 4 hours and change. So he didn't fall asleep nor get mugged while he was jogging in Philly. So.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. That he could do that. That's pretty amazing. When I was a kid, the place where I first started cooking when I was like 13 years old, was connected to a bar, and there were all these like steel workers, union guys and everything. And they used to, they would start their own brand of competitive eating weeks before Thanksgiving, because their whole philosophy, like, they'd come in with bags of McDonald's and like five pizzas each and all that stuff, and they would stretch, the whole thing was stretching the stomach. But that's not entirely true, huh?
No, the stomach is a little bit like an accordion. It will snap back. It will recover. All you'll get out of the large meal scenario is you kind of wake up and you're used to being hungry. So you have a mental mind over stomach matter, thinking you're hungry. But to be honest, what you're doing is creating a very dangerous log flume-like ride from your esophagus to your lower intestine. And unless you're like me and you enjoy wearing a comfortable adult diaper at the Thanksgiving table, then you could run into some problems.
But the other guests aren't that crazy about it.
Well, no, because they come in six packs, so I offer five. I have five other guests.
That way you don't have to get up.
It's only polite.
You never have to leave the table.
Of course.
Oh, keeping it classy, people.
Keeping it classy.
Any truth that the movie Flashdance was based on that bar in your childhood, but they just switched the gender? They were like Chef Paul or Jennifer Beals?
No, only if they had like buckets of beer and cocaine dumping on people in the chair.
A different movie.
Although some of those iron workers did like to wear their sweatshirts hanging off one shoulder.
The disco
and they ate lobster too, right?
They ate a lot of lobster.
Who is that voice, Chef
so,
Paul?
So, yes, let us, now that we're keeping it fucking classy, let's bring on
Wayne's World.
Excellent, party time.
Let's bring on our recognized brand marketer with culinary, 25 years of expert experience.
Did you say 45 years?
25. Oh, okay. 25. Because you started when you were five.
Exactly.
She's been named the A-list of 2009. She was a food media background, including an editor at Savour.
Publisher
of Savour.
Right.
Let's just bring her on instead of me reading all this crap. Her name is Mary Lee Kingsley, and we are very happy to have you with us, Mary. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Out here in no man's land of Brooklyn, we actually got you out of the Upper West Side today, so welcome.
It's like hanging with the boys. It's nice.
Hanging with the boys.
The homies. Mm-hmm. Hanging with the homies.
The Brooklyn boys. You're going to be going to your meetings tomorrow, and you're going to be like, let me tell you something, you fucking jerk-offs.
If I don't start my meeting off with yo, then there's something really wrong with my night.
I don't say yo.
I know you don't say yo. No.
So how's it going? Thank you so much for taking the trek out here to Brooklyn.
No, it's nice. I've already, you know, this is, I don't know, I don't think I've ever gone that far on the L train, so thanks.
Oh, you haven't lived till you've gone to Canarsie.
Oh, yeah, seriously.
Canarsie.
East New York, it's East New York.
Yes.
I did go, but I had a little time before one of the shows, and I just said, I'm going to ride the L to the end of the line, which is the Canarsie Pier.
Right.
And I had to walk a long while. It's just cement. It's just a giant block of cement.
Yes.
And there was a taco truck.
They're not doing any. They're not doing any postcards.
No. No.
Wish you were here. Yeah.
Wish you weren't here. Yeah.
But that could be a new business venture. That's like a great idea.
If you like put on goggles and look in the water, it's just a bunch of skeletons with cement shoes down below there.
So you mostly spend your time on the Upper West Side of Manhattan?
No, I mean, I spend my time, most of my time is spent downtown.
Okay.
I mean, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of incredible restaurants on the Upper West Side. Some have tried.
Except for
many
Ease.
Many have failed.
There is Ease Bar.
Oh, there is. Oh, without, Ease Bar. Right, yeah. Right. With my chicken
511
thangs.
511 Amsterdam Avenue. The food is fantastic.
No nepotism here.
You know
anyway.
What? Slowly, it's slowly happening. But I think, you know, most of the people that I adore are downtown, and so I spend most of my time downtown.
Do you find that's because I do some bartending on the Upper East Side? I find it's a lot of New York chains, you know, like Patsy's Pizza, Second Ave Deli, and like going from VHS copy to VHS copy, the facsimiles are less and less exciting than the originals.
I don't know. I mean, I think Red Farm is great on the Upper West Side. I think, you know, Michael Salakis has done really well, you know, on the Upper West Side. John Fraser, who has Dovetail, has done really well on the Upper West Side. It's such a finicky area because you have half families. You don't have people who want to really spend, you know, a ton of money. Ed Brown had a great restaurant for a while, and it didn't work. It was in the when the economy was tanking. Right. So it's really kind of a yin and yang place. It's either really hit or miss.
Well, and it's not the destination that downtown is. It's not the destination Brooklyn's become. I mean, and it is there is the college crowd, you know, which is always going to add to some level of eating and drinking, but it's not like tourists are coming from all over the world to go to the Upper West Side. As
hashtag
as it
UWS, it's not trending. Right. It's not trending yet.
Right, right. But there is a. I mean, Bustan's
great.
Which
I love
is
Bustan.
Incredible. Just got best restaurant on the Upper West Side. It happens to be amazing. I mean, Guy Goldstein, who's worked at a ton of restaurants, and his chef Effie have created something really special. The meatball shop guys have done really well right up there. But Daniel and Michael have done well everywhere. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time downtown. It's not like I don't get out of the hood.
Yeah, I used to get nosebleeds going about
the white bread hood, so to speak. I say I live in the suburbs of Manhattan.
So you've been in food, mostly food publishing for about 25 years, or at least in the publishing world.
I you know, I have worked at Food & Wine. I've worked at Bon Appetit. I ran Savour for years. I spent a year away from the publishing world going to the Culinary Institute and becoming a certified pastry chef, which I don't get. I mean, I do a lot of baking, but I don't do incredible, amazing.
You haven't taken a $9 an hour job?
No.
As a
no, I don't wake
pastry
up if,
player.
If I'm up at 4 a.m. It's because I've been out for the night. I have a very connected passion to the world of food, and I've always tried to find a way to take my passion and make it a business without having to be in the kitchen, which has been really a unique situation I've been in, actually.
When did you, like years ago, when did you notice the change? What was the pivotal thing that you said, everybody's starting to move toward food right now? Because when I started cooking in the 80s, it still hadn't happened yet. You know, it was a very niche kind of spot, you know, and you had people like, you know, Gail Green, and you had the writers in the Times and Craig and all that kind of stuff, but it hadn't taken off. It hadn't become pop culture like it is today. So what was your pivotal moment that made you notice it?
I think still, like, when I graduated CIA, it was 93, and the Food Network still wasn't the Food Network. I mean, there was no real celebrity chef anything at the time.
Well, there was Julia Child. There was the people we grew up
with. Yeah, we grew up with,
the Frugal Gourmet. I used to love
Gourmet. Yeah, right.
It's wonderful.
The Galloping Gourmet,
Galloping Gourmet I loved from when I was a kid, Graham Kerr.
Exactly. Yeah. I used to watch him as well. And I think so there, you know, what happened was, even when the Food Network started, it was great. I mean, it was like for people who really were food enthusiasts. Like, we had talked a little bit about that word foodie.
So you don't use the word foodie?
No way. Because it's become so vanilla is what's happened with that word foodie. And everybody can call anyone who enjoys food is a foodie. And somebody who is passionate and interested, I would call more of a food enthusiast. Is what I would use.
Crazy Legs, do you say that a lot, like in your eating competitions? Do you say, I'm totes a foodie?
Hashtag totes a foodie.
Hashtag totes a foodie.
Only when I'm on the Upper West Side. No, mostly my mouth is filled during the competition. I guess you could text while eating, but you really need, I needed both hands for that 20-pound turkey.
I have a theory, actually, about why people became so into food, because the 70s and the 80s, well, 60s, 70s, 80s were such a drug culture decades that eventually everybody started getting sober and they had to focus on something else. And then everybody started getting really into food. I mean, it seems like, you know, cocaine kind of went by the wayside, and then everybody was into food.
Is that why Fluffernutter went so well? Like, people were really buying fluff off the shelves, and it was amazing. I couldn't figure it out.
Drugs aren't the culture anymore. You know? Food is the culture.
Fluffernutter did so well because with peanut butter, it's pure heaven.
Oh, my God. It's amazing. I'm like a diehard fluff and peanut butter.
It's
fantastic.
What you're saying is the mound of cocaine. If they filmed Scarface years later, he would be like, say hello to my Himalayan sea salt.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, he's got a lot of Himalayan sea salt in that pot. Exactly.
Yeah, it'd be like ramen burgers.
He's overseasoning that.
The schmeatball schmop.
I don't know. I think that I really do believe that the Food Network really created a culture, and then what they did with it is they somewhat ruined the culture.
Let's be honest. What happened basically, I mean, from the media standpoint was, it was the perfect mix for the perfect advertiser. And the reason is, in America, the two industries that spend more in advertising than anything else on the planet are food and retail. So therefore, you're telling...
Retail porn, you mean, right?
No, Target retail. I mean, seriously.
Oh, okay.
So what happens is, if you have a situation where you're giving them a direct channel to the people who are interested in this, the money rains from the sky. You know, all of a sudden, these people who are trying to find different places to put their food, you know, in some cases, a lot of it went to like Saturday morning cartoons because kids were a big food audience because they wanted the kids to buy all the crap. All of a sudden, you know, all your Lean Cuisines and your, you know, these companies that Kraft and Mondelez and, you know, Procter & Gamble and Unilever and they basically, in Conagra, have a place that you could funnel all the money, and they know that all the return on their investment is coming back from one interest set.
Right, we all have to eat.
Well,
yeah, exactly.
The other thing is that you brought up an interesting point about Julia Child. If you remember the movie Julia, mm-hmm. the woman who redid her entire cookbook was young. She was mm-hmm. like what we would call a millennial, which is so annoying.
I call it annoying.
But it's the age group where advertisers felt their money was going to be spent, and the next generation. And so everybody focused on that, right? That's mm-hmm. why we have YouTube. That's why, you know, everybody all of a sudden began to focus on the internet. So if you look at YouTube, YouTube is the number one place that millennial moms will go to for how to cook. That generation that's concerned about where the origin of their food is, right? Non-GMOs, they all shop at the farmer's market. You know, they're growing things in urban areas. They're growing them in, like, trash containers on top of their roofs in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You know, the generation after us has really changed the way food culture is. And I think that they just kind of pushed it to a whole different level after we started being interested in it.
So you're saying Amy Adams watches my YouTube series Drunken Chef, where I take my shirt off, I get really drunk, and then I try to recreate recipes.
No, I heard Amy Adams
get down
was
with the caucus.
Actually eating turkey competitively.
Oh, well, you know, Olivia Wilde ate a lot of pancakes back in the day. So that's who I dream
I would like
about.
To see that.
Oh, my goodness.
Definitely
I would, too.
I'd pay top dollar.
Yeah.
You said the site is called YouTube, and I can find that on there?
YouTube. Let me write that down.
What is this YouTube you speak
of? I find it interesting, though. I don't know if the word is interesting. It might be entirely frustrating. Is that the way that chefs became portrayed? Because, and it's a frustration of a lot of my colleagues as much as it was good for the business and everybody being into food and being concerned about where their food comes from, and a lot of good things happened with the food craze, but it also really fucked up behind the swinging doors because everybody suddenly wanted to be a chef, and it just messed up the business because the business itself hasn't changed. The urgency hasn't changed, and the hard work and the hours and all those things that go into being a cook before you can earn the title of chef. Everybody thought that they would just go to culinary school and they would get that diploma and then they would walk in and be like, hey, what's up?
Or they'd be on TV.
Well,
Or they would be on TV. Exactly. Yeah. You know, the crisp white chef coat and the glass of red wine, you know, sitting at the table and everybody bowing down to them. And that's just not the case.
Yeah, I think that in some ways the chefs are responsible for the culture. Sometimes the restaurateurs are responsible. Some people like to hire CIA grads, as you know, Paul. Some people can't stand to hire CIA grads. They'd rather hire somebody who's come up from the kitchen and doesn't do things in the box where they were taught. So that's a restaurateur that has nothing to do with the 50 million people who want to go to culinary school.
Right.
And the chefs...
But even the culinary schools are getting sued. You know, there's all those stories about them getting sued because all these people, like, you know, I graduated, I got my certificate, and now I can only get a job in Starbucks. You know, nobody's hiring me. Because they're really misled.
Neither can the guys from Harvard who get their MBAs, on Wall Street. So, you know, I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, it's the industry.
I mean, that's
general.
Ridiculous. Suing a school because you can't get a job, you know, coming from a high school dropout who's been at jobs in media my entire life without, you know, ever having taken a college course.
Right, right.
You know, it's like you're suing the college because you suck. I did go to college for a little while. I went to art school. You know what? And know what happened? I found out I was a shitty artist. So guess what? I didn't go into.
You're a great artist.
I know, but commercially, I wasn't going to be able to follow it. You know, I realized I can't do this for money.
Right.
So guess what? I don't do for money.
Right.
Right. But it definitely takes a certain work ethic. But I'm just amazed at how the restaurant business that I started in that has entirely changed now. To me, was more akin to Led Zeppelin on the road, and then the Food Network wrapped it up and sold it as Pat Boone.
Right. Well, then you want to talk about the celebrity chefs. I mean, we get, you know, these guys, somebody, you know, the Food Network is really who created it. And then everybody wanted to jump on the bandwagon, and the Food Network just looked for people who they thought would resonate with an audience. And then it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Do you think it was the Food Network, or do you think it was more Martha Stewart? And even though it wasn't that she created a channel, but she did create a media, like a media kind of mini empire around it.
But she never had these shows where it was like Be the Next Star.
But she created
competitions.
But she created a magazine. She created a website.
But Martha's a different. Martha was, you know, the Food Network turned into a reality show, game show network. It wasn't like that to begin with.
Right.
You know, it wasn't meant
sort of like
to
MTV
be like
no longer showing music videos. It's like all of a sudden the Food Network is highlighting. And I guess my question would be, they create these celebrity chefs. Does that take away from the food that these people are making, preparing?
They don't care.
Because people are saying, I'm going to this restaurant because I saw this guy on TV, so it must be good. And are they fooling themselves into thinking that it is good?
Paul and I had a conversation about that. You know, to me, there are three types of chefs. There are those that just want to be a celebrity, right? They just want to be on TV. They want to be spokespeople. They want to have sponsors. They want to make a lot of money, and they want to be chefs. They don't want to cook. There are those that want to be restaurateurs mm-hmm. and own a lot of restaurants, mm-hmm. and that makes them happy. And then there are those people who are constantly inspired by being in the kitchen and watching people enjoy everything that they create.
The masochist.
They're right.
That's me.
Exactly.
Yes, that would be
right.
You, Chef Paul.
So, right. But you love it. But, Paul, you know, you are very unique in that you're not only a chef, but you're a talented writer. And
now you know why she's on, but go ahead.
Right, if you looked at my Facebook page, you would have been able to see that. No, but I think that, you know, there are many levels of creativity that go into somebody who can do multi-talented things. And
that's what I loved about the business when I first came in, because I could play in a band, and I could write, and I could have long hair, and I could do what I wanted to do and be who I wanted to be, and it was another creative outlet. That has changed quite a bit in this business. So look, we're going to take a quick station identification break, and then we're going to come back and talk to you a little bit more about media, culinary, and I want to touch on sexy chefs. Mm-hmm.
I'm
listening to Wake Up by Eula.
Brandon Boy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
All right, Andrew WK promo. That's pretty good. The guy who is famous for having pictures of him with blood dripping down his chin.
That was ketchup.
That is Heritage blood that's dripping Heritage down his chin.
Single origin artisanal blood. Single,
locally sourced.
Small batch. Small blood. Yep. So we're here with Mary Lee Kingsley, former publisher of Savoir magazine, talking about media and food. Thank you very much for joining us. So I'm going to try and get those two words out of my mouth again. Sexy chefs. I love the articles about all these sexy. I can't fucking say it. It's very
sexy,
difficult.
Sexy
she shells down by the sexy chefs.
Sexy chef.
I always get a kick out of all these different articles that come up because, you know, it's like we were talking about before, like a lot of these guys who got their own TV shows got their TV shows because they can cook, which has nothing to do with entertainment. And it's kind of ridiculous because, I don't know, it's appealing to somebody. It's not appealing to me. But, you know, I was never one of those pop phenomenon kind of guys. But I just think it's funny when you see these pictures of all these people that are classified as sexy. I mean, it's ridiculous. David Chang tops a lot of these fucking lists.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and it would
be like, God, really?
I'll tell you what, though, that Batali one of him in the Speedo,
that's pretty good, right?
I tell you, it just does it for me. I don't know what it is.
If he would
just slip the Crocs off, it would just.
I see those pictures and it makes me think, like, you know, like if they had a list of like sexy actors and like fucking Corky from Life Goes On is on there. That's what he looks like. Come on, that's what David Chang
but
looks,
you know,
like.
Though,
I mean, come on.
Maybe though, that's why it's so easy to pick the sexy ones out of the small field.
But
right?
how does sexy correlate with the skill of cooking? I understand that chefs can be very sexy and knowing how to cook is very sexy.
But at the same time, are we going, hey, the sexiest politicians around? I mean, what does that have to do with being a politician? Yet they do that too.
Ones that are sexy, though, don't seem to be the ones that are celebrity status. I mean, it's to me, you know, I always had my two favorites, you know, and I used to tell them it was Seamus Mullen and it was Scott Conan, and they're both like brothers, and they're both married, but and they're both, you know, Scott is on Chopped, and he is has a lot of restaurants.
The only people listening are their wives, but go ahead.
And you know what? The interesting thing is I'm friends with Seamus's wife, so that's totally fine. But I think that, you know, I think that everybody has a different kind of sexy, and to some people it's creative and cerebral, and to other people it's looks. And I think the reason why Marcus had won People Magazine's one of the sexiest men of the year,
Samuelson.
Right. He was at Aquavit when he had gotten that years and years ago.
I don't find him sexy, but his scarves are. His fancy fedoras,
I find
very sexy.
Mark Murphy was just named one of People Magazine's Sexiest People of the Year this year. And I love Mark, and I adore his wife. I just think that...
I like how you keep mentioning their wives.
I do.
You don't get in trouble at a cocktail party later.
I do, and I did. I actually did say to Pam on Facebook that I felt that they need to name a sexiest couple. I think that when they use the word sexy and they put it in the media, it's just because they feel like it's such an important part of culture. Food is such an important part of culture. that they need to find somebody to throw in the mix.
Right.
And they need a celebrity. They need a...
Well, it's also because media has become a listicle central. You know, everything is like top 10 this, five that, top 6 this. BuzzFeed has destroyed us with lists. I mean, I'm at the point where it's like 20 lists about lists writing lists. You know, it's gotten to the point where it's all charticles. You know,
you're right.
What's a charticle?
A charticle.
That's a good word.
Well, a charticle is like remember, like when you used to read Max. It's more online now. But remember, you read Max magazine, and it'd be something on the side.
I only looked at the pictures.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Well, on the side of the picture.
Okay, on the side of the picture.
Yeah. That's a charticle.
Yeah, it's like short attention span reading.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
They ruined that magazine, though. Have you seen it recently?
No, it's still out.
Maxim.
That's
a quality read.
It's a pamphlet.
It's like they just want to sell like high end goods.
It's all
they had. Speaking of lists, they had like the top 5 cigars. 4 of them were Cuban. So I'm like, I can't get these.
Well, they just got a huge influx of cash. And, huge influx of cash. So they'll probably be doing something different with that magazine shortly.
Yeah, where the pictures of the girl in the bikini was, there's now like an $11,000 watch.
Well, the reason being, first of all, online media has basically destroyed the magazine industry in America. Yeah. I can tell you that completely objectively. Not so much in Europe. People still read magazines in Europe. You still make money on a newsstand in Europe. You can still actually sell magazines, and that's a profit. That hasn't happened in America in a very long time. But the reason is because they are begging that watch company to please put something in there. You know, that separation of church and state, editorial and advertising, very blurred these days. And it gets even more and more blurred. And like I was mentioning, this magazine's a pan. Do you remember how thick Maxim used to be? You used to be able to knock out a gorilla with Maxim.
You really liked Maxim magazine.
No, well, Mary, let me ask you this about the publishing world. Did you find in the food world that the Reverend said, that the advertising started to bleed into the editorial, that you couldn't write an article about pasta if you didn't mention Barilla or somebody?
When I left Savour, it was just beginning, which they call everything native, right? They all have they all have a lovely name right?
That's an advertorial. It's a way to cheat and say, we're going to talk about your brand and make it look like editorial.
Right, exactly.
They call it native advertising.
We're going to give you sponsored edit. I think that the problem is that you know, in the industry, we all know that somebody's paying for the edit. The reader doesn't really know what they're getting. The food media is such a blur now, right? So you have Food & Wine, you have the Food Network, you have Bon Appetit, and you have Savour, and then you have Meredith, who owns everything from All Recipes, which started as a website and then became a magazine, which is a very common thing these days. In fact, like I was just reading the other day, Airbnb is about to launch a magazine, which is...
Instead of a hotel rental company,
right? They are a hotel. They're rooming.
Yep. Like look inside people's apartments that you're not supposed to be in.
It's like a destination travel kind of site. Another one. GoPro is starting their own media channel.
Well, look what Red Bull did. Red Bull is a brilliant. They're the most brilliant marketer in the world. What they've accomplished is incredible. I mean, I always use them as an example, but.
Yeah, but they're not selling energy drinks. They're selling an experience.
Yeah, exactly. but they use their audience. I mean, to me, it's always been about your audience and your readership and, you know, your viewers. Like, what do you do with them? And I think one of the things that was so interesting about the internet early on is that when people started a website, is that there was no depth. It was always about, you can connect with our users. But yet they didn't know how to host an event.
Nope.
And they didn't have a number of platforms. But the magazine people had the opportunity to connect with their readers and find out what they were reading all along, and they didn't do that either.
No, and the problem was there was that it's just a fad. Then when it wasn't a fad, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job.
Right.
And then it was like, okay, I better get on this now. Oh, wow, I'm too late. There's already web publishers that are doing this better than me.
Right. So when the magazine guys kind of whined about like, oh my God, I'm losing all my revenue to the web guys, then the web guys all of a sudden were like, oh my God, we're in a sea of sameness because we don't know how to get depth by connecting with the people who keep looking at our websites. You know, then all of a sudden in like a moment's notice, everything changed to just the amount of numbers and how you could bid on getting there. So it became very much, everything became programmatic. So it really became less about, to me, substance.
And for our listener who doesn't know what programmatic is? It's actually
sorry.
It's interesting. These ads aren't sold anymore; they're bid on.
Right, they're
bid on. When you go online and you see a banner ad on one of your on whatever website you're looking at, they actually bid and said, "I will take that banner ad for $5 per 1,000 eyeballs who sees it." And then someone goes, "I'll take it for $6." Hmm. The guy who put $6 and gets it.
Wow.
Right. You know,
whatever brand that is.
So it's sad.
It's sad. So not to leave the bleak, desolate wasteland of food media, but this is essentially our Thanksgiving show coming up. I guess I would touch on that for a moment.
Yes.
In the fact that I have tomorrow at some point a... Heritage turkey is going to arrive at my apartment.
Oh, very nice.
Yes, from Heritage.
Are you going to share it? Are you going to eat the whole thing by yourself?
I am going to bring it to where I bartend. I'll be working there on Thanksgiving, Upper East Side, 1st Ave, 73rd Street. And the kitchen staff's going to cook it, and then we're going to eat it because no one else is going to be in the restaurant. So, so I'm looking forward to that. Thanksgiving, obviously, perhaps co-opted. It's sort of like Christmas music a month before. I would imagine the food media... You know, Food Network has Thanksgiving shows running all the time, yep. Magazines, whatnot. Is there anything in that morass of Thanksgiving prep that everyone's looking forward to, I guess I would ask?
What are you asking?
Asking everybody. Everybody here, the co-host. What are you looking forward to at Thanksgiving?
Just the general gratitude.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, don't tell me Christmas you're looking forward to peace on earth.
Yes.
All right, well, I'll mark that down.
It's Thanksgiving in New York. You know that the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade used to be the Macy's Christmas Parade.
Yeah.
And now it's the Thanksgiving Parade.
Right.
And then, you know, just a couple of weeks down a couple of seasons down the road, it's going to be the Macy's Day Parade.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that's basically one of the things that it's just... I have a problem.
Miracle
with
Miracle on 34th Street.
They're selling ad space for the parades.
I have a problem with Thanksgiving. It's just as commercialized as Christmas is, and we are celebrating genocide. So I mean, I'm sorry,
Jesus.
No, but you know what? The best thing was when Paul and I were walking here tonight from the subway, is the Christmas trees were already out, and it was just the smell of pine that was so awesome.
But it's 70 degrees out, which is
I
weird.
Know, which is even better.
Palm Springs
more
Christmas.
But that to me is what the holidays represent. It's just that amazing smell in the air, and forget the commercialism, but
I love
spirit.
It does get to you. It does. I might sound smug when I said the general gratitude, but I mean it. I mean, I mean that.
Yes, and it's nice that Mary points that out, whereas... The Reverend.
I'm a complete
Grinch. He's enjoying
he's a total.
The smell of genocide on Thanksgiving.
He's a total cynic, whereas it just sounds like I'm being cynical. You know, and I'm like, the fucking gratitude. But I actually mean it.
All right.
Yeah.
No, I am completely. I love getting together with family. I love the food portion of it. I love the idea of getting together. But I'm like, well, why don't we do this twice a week? Why do we have to wait till this one time a year?
Hey, come on, really? You think that's a possibility?
He doesn't like the structure.
No, but it's just it's ridiculous. It's like I have to be nice to everybody this time of year. I have to be grateful right now. I was grateful last week. Why do I have to be grateful this week?
That's good.
I actually have a group of friends, and it's a group of very creative people and artists, and all over the country and several different continents that we email each other. There's about 15 people on the list, and there's an ongoing gratitude list that everybody sends out regularly.
And you hold? Then do you wait till Thanksgiving to send it to everybody?
No, it goes out.
That's what I'm saying. That's
every day. Not every single person fills it out every day, I get an email every single day from one of those people with their list on it for
that day. That sounds both emotionally and spiritually healthy. Thanksgiving and Christmas for me are neither of those things.
Well, you know what sounds a little messed up is the having a Thanksgiving turkey eating contest. Was that a Native American casino?
Yes, it is.
You know what I noticed? Though? It was nice that the Native Americans could find the Chinese to take advantage of. The whole place was filled with Chinese losing their money.
Chinese dressed like pilgrims?
Yeah. I mean, it was politically correct.
Well, there's
more.
It's the top... Asian American casino in the country is Foxwoods.
Wow.
In other words, they get more Asian American. There's a big Asian American community that gambles,
right?
But more go to Foxwoods than any other casino.
So don't
in America.
You feel good that they found somebody else to pick on?
That's how it goes, man. That's how it goes. You know, the Irish picked on the Italians, and then it goes on and on and on. Yeah. Whoever comes. whoever comes gets beat up, and then you pick somebody else. And the next new guy is about to get a foot in the ass.
Yeah, but the Irish,
the Mexicans are getting it now.
Yeah, the Irish would beat up to the Italians to the point of like, oh, well, you can't have a job. They didn't come over, give them syphilis, and take all their shit. Okay, like the Europeans did to the Native Americans. All right, it's a little different. You know,
maybe we can go on about that. Let me ask you something about the food and media. It's interesting that everything you're saying about like the selling the brand space and all that, but now everything has become brands. It's all about connecting to brands. It's the only way to really get anything done these days is to connect to the brands. They're the ones with the money. Do you think it has hurt the creativity from TV, radio, aside from this show, of course.
Because the creativity is beyond.
But like the creativity and the content that is being provided on TV now and in magazines and in print all over, is it all just based on brands and selling some sort of connection?
I think it raises the bar. I think that, you know, if you're there's more platforms for content. So if you're a creative person, you have so many options. You can go to American Express and you can say, I've created this short film. Do you have interest in putting it on your website to engage your, you know, the people who come to your website?
Experiential marketing.
Right.
That's the whole thing.
You know, do you take it to Netflix? No. Do you take it to an HBO? Do you take it to a network? I think that as I'd mentioned to you before, I think what's happened is the networks were at one time competing with the cable, and now everybody is competing with the internet. And the internet doesn't just mean a Netflix or a Hulu. The internet means everybody beyond Yahoo. I mean, this is a perfect example of, you know, of Heritage Radio kind of creating their own little niche and, you know, people listening to them. And
really?
It is.
The internet killed the food TV star.
Hey now.
Exactly. And if you're creative, like, you guys have the opportunity to say, gee, I'm thinking we're going to like talk about this, but nobody else is really talking about it, so we have this platform to do it. And that's the beauty of what's going on today.
That's our show in a nutshell. At Eating Disorder, we talk about what no one else is talking
about.
Well, I think that the thing that's important about this show that we wanted to do is kind of lighten it up a little bit because, mm-hmm. you know, the food to me was always about eat, drink, and be merry.
Yeah.
You know, and
no pun intended.
No, totally intended, because a lot of it to me has gotten. Yeah, I got it. A lot of it has just gotten so fucking serious. You know, like, yes, it's very important that we are focused on GMOs and every other horrific thing that is connected to food, and we need to know those things.
And source locally, and the environment, and the things we always talk about, the allergies, and the health issues.
It's all very, very necessary, but there has to be some fun, you know, like there has to be a little bit of goofballing around and just, you know, remembering like what we're about here, you know.
But authentic goofballing, right? Not game show shit.
I have no choice but to be an authentic goofball. I mean, it's not like,
you know, but that's the difference, right? You guys are authentic versus going out and watching some game show about a roulette wheel that like makes somebody cook shit.
And it's you say game show, my thing is like morning show bullshit, you know, like we were talking about. What was that? We were just talking about
the Chew,
right?
You know, which is, I mean, I watched the show today. I wanted to poke my eyes out with forks. I was like, this is so put on, and it's so schmaltzy.
But think about what happened. The soap opera is dead, and the Chew is relevant. And to me, that is what's transformed the world of food.
But I want my stories back. But that's soap operas.
Spiro. Like, you know, you want Maxim. You know, this is the Chew, and the housewife that's home taking care of her child understands what Daphne Oz, who just had a baby, is doing.
Right?
And then they have somebody else who talks about crafts. And Mario and Michael play off each other. And then they have celebrities who are on the show who are from Scandal or who are from a soap opera. Like, these are people who are relevant in the world of people who stay at home with their kids.
Right.
Get.
I often wonder what Lindsay Lohan has on her salad.
Hey now, let's get it tossed.
Oh,
all terrible. Right, everybody. That's we'll end it on that note. Mary, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for
having
me.
Have anything you'd like to plug or any words of wisdom as we
this was so much
sign
fun.
Out?
Thank you for having me.
You didn't ruin any relationships. You didn't burn any bridges.
Oh my god,
yeah.
I'm so happy.
You were on your best behavior.
I wish we could have talked about.
We still got a couple of seconds. If you want to throw
No.
The
my
bus.
Chef friends will all be happy that I didn't do anything wrong. Thanks.
I only so referred much. To Davis Chang as Corky from Life.
No. I can't believe you said that. I mean, you have said a lot of things that have shocked me. That must have been like Corky, really.
He's excellent in Treme, though.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Eating Disorder, and we will see you next week.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy or.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.